Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, your host of Speaking Broadly, and on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I introduce you to extraordinary people working in the food world who share their successes and their challenges. On today's show, one woman I've known for years who's impressed me with her honesty and her pursuit of excellence, whether competing on Top Chef or writing a cookbook. She is one of my guests. And another is a woman who I just met who's changing the lives of Bangladeshi women in Detroit. But first, I'm going to tell you about a meal that I recently ate. I was in Raleigh-Durham to do a Q&A with star chef Vivian Howard. Maybe you've seen her show. It's called A Chef's Life. If you haven't, you need to check it out. Her producer and partner, Cynthia Hill, has created a completely different type of food TV. Instead of everything feeling either perfect, manufactured, or on the other side, like reality TV, this is like a blooper reel of life. It's so real and so engaging. In any case, that's why I was in Raleigh-Durham and why I went to this restaurant called Piedmont, because the chef there had once worked for Vivian Howard at her restaurant, Chef and the Farmer. So it was brunch. It was a special brunch because of the premiere. And the dish that I cannot get out of my mind is a deep fried chicken liver. Now, part of the reason I can't get it out of my mind is that they were so good, I had to hold myself back. Like, I only ate one and a half of them, but there were three, and I'm still sort of longing for those I didn't have. But if you can imagine something that is like crinkly and sort of shaped like a rock that fell from Earth, like an asteroid, that is a nutty brown, and when you bite into it, it's really crunchy, but inside, it's kind of that creamy chicken liver thing. It was juicy, and you're in the South, and that's exactly what things are supposed to taste like in the South and look like there. And it was awesome. On to my first guest. My first guest is Emily Stagaitis from Bandhu Gardens in Detroit. Emily works with Bangladeshi women to bring produce from their incredible home gardens to restaurants in the area. She's a tremendous inspiration to me.
I am thrilled to be talking to you, Emily. Thank you so much for joining me on Speaking Broadly.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So visiting you in Detroit and seeing your organization, Bandhu Gardens, in action was the highlight of my trip. I'm so in awe of what you've done, helping Bangladeshi women gardeners bring their produce to restaurants and find a market for that, and also find a market for their skill as cooks in catering. Tell me, how did you begin Bandhu Gardens?
Well, so to start with, the word, our name, Bandhu Gardens, is Bandhu is the Bangla word for friend. So the idea of kind of growing friendship. And that's really where it all came from, was when I moved to the neighborhood, a woman named Minara had also just moved to the neighborhood, and she had moved from Bangladesh. And she spoke no English, and I spoke no Bangla, but we just connected really deeply. And the gardens and the kitchen were really the way that we connected. And so as a gardener and as a cook myself, it's, you know, it's a language that you don't necessarily need words for. You know, it's a language of smells and sights and of doing and handwork. And so we just kind of worked alongside each other and became better friends and learned each other's language through the names of vegetables and the names of foods. So that's how it really got started. And then through working with restaurants in the city, we were able to start selling the vegetables. And one of the things that we would do every time that we sold vegetables to a new account is that we would invite people over to the house to taste, you know, this is how these vegetables that are being grown here, these South Asian vegetables like bitter melon and long bean, there's real people behind them, you know, and it matters what when you order and if you order consistently, but also to understand what people were doing with them in their kitchens, so that when the vegetables kind of traveled into a different chef's kitchen, they would at least have an understanding of kind of what the history and the narrative and that rich tradition that the vegetables were coming out of.
I didn't realize that you had the chefs over. Did they go to Manara's, which is where we were?
And yeah, so that was a really key piece of it, because it wasn't just about, you know, kind of growing friendship between me and Minara and these other ladies in the neighborhood, but the idea of growing friendship between cooks and gardeners, you know, and really trying to create a more robust relationship and set of and kind of a set of accountability, especially as the restaurant scene here is picking up and, you know, different cuisines are really being highlighted and celebrated. You know, how do we make sure that the growers of the produce that makes this food so great are also being celebrated and really honored for their knowledge?
So what are some of the greens that they grow, and how is it possible to grow enough to feed a restaurant?
Well, and so that's one of the things. So when we're working with families, it's families who are all growing for their own personal use first and foremost. So and these are families that, you know, in Bangladesh owned rice fields and tea fields and mango trees and, you know, and are coming from a really robust tradition of agriculture. And so when they're planting here, they are, they're intercropping and they're trellising and really just squeezing as much out of these pretty small backyard gardens as possible. And so one of the ways that we are able to supply to restaurants is that a lot of people are growing the same thing at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So if the restaurant needs 30 pounds of beans, it might, you know, sometimes it might be 30 pounds from one gardener, but other times it might be that I go to three gardeners and get 10 pounds each, or 10 gardeners and get 3 pounds each. So there's a lot of coordination work that goes on, but, you know, another way of thinking about that is that there's a lot of relationship building that goes on.
Right. And I think one point that you've made about this in the past is that this is women's work. It's something that the women have complete control over. The men in these families, they have jobs. They go off to the jobs. But this has given the women a sense of control and purpose. Is that the right way to put it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, one of the things that I saw when I moved to the neighborhood is that, you know, these ladies, like my friends Minara and Salima and Mamota and Razna, are all working so hard, you know, every day, you know, to cook for 6 or 7 people in their household and doing all the gardening. But then when, you know, even the Bangladeshi restaurants here, which are great, you know, and it's great to have local restaurants, but they're all run by men. And so just kind of looking at that and saying, like, well, how do we honor this work that is being done, and how do we create a platform for this work? And then kind of create a social network, too, you know, because for men, a lot of social relationships are developed through the network of jobs. And if you come and you don't have a job, it's a harder network. You know, it's harder to socially network. And so so just offering some opportunities for cross-pollination within our neighborhood, but then also thinking about the broader community, you know, the food affinity community, not just our geographic community, our ethnic community, but how do we use food to kind of define our community? And so creating relationships within, you know, a lot of the restaurants we work with are women-owned, like and food has been one of our dearest friends and connections, and the farmer's hand with Kiki and Rohani. So we're women working in the neighborhood together and then working with other women-owned businesses. And so this idea of women supporting women supporting women.
And what has the reception been in Detroit? Those first chefs that you invited in, and have they become part of your world and they're terribly supportive? Or
definitely, yeah. And that's actually how we started doing the pop-up dinner events, is that after having a couple of the chefs over for meals, this is like, oh my God, this is the best food in the city. You know, like, this is what we want to be eating. You guys should, you know, do you want to do a pop-up restaurant at ours? And so then, you know, so we had hosted them in our neighborhood, and then they in turn opened up, essentially their home, their restaurants to us, and said like, hey, you know, like, be the hostess here. And so, so there's a real reciprocity, and now we'll go places and, you know, people will recognize each other. And so it's a really exciting way to be kind of broadening everyone's horizons, and using food as that bridge.
And so how has this changed your own life? Because you had a job and you've given up that job to take this on. Has it changed you in some fundamental way?
Immensely so. And I think the biggest thing was learning how to accept help. It's easy to make a simple narrative about helping, you know, and from the outside, sometimes people will say like, oh my gosh, you're so good to help these families. And I say, oh, you have no idea. They take care of me. For the first 6 months that I lived in the neighborhood, I didn't cook once.
Wow.
I had different families, you know, like vying for like, no, I'm cooking for her today. No, I'm cooking for her today. And to learn to receive that, you know, because the skills that I was bringing to the table, like, you know, being able to translate forms or drive to the grocery store or use my English literacy, came so naturally to me that I didn't think about those as, a source of power. And so to humble myself and say like, yes, thank you, I'll allow you to cook for me, and recognize that helped me immensely and that I can receive that, was, I think, one of the biggest lessons, and has really ensured that there's not a hierarchy, you know, that we're really peers within this food space, who are just bringing different skill sets to the table and doing things together that we couldn't do separately.
You also are helping them, I think you were mentioning, with some life skills. You're taking kids to doctor's appointments, or, you know, being a translator. So from food, you've really sort of become completely intertwined in their lives. Food has such an amazing power to connect. What do you imagine is the way this program could grow? Because I think, am I right to say that you work with 6 women right now?
Do you think
that it could grow? Do you think that this is just the exact right number of people, and this is what you as one person can do?
Well, so that's, I have people knocking on my door and saying, can you sell my squash? You know, so I think that there is, within the community, there is a demand for, you know, bringing additional vegetables to market, you know, and also, you know, ladies will say like, oh, like, you have to taste my samosas. And so there's this, you know, cooking really is a sense of pride, you know, and it's this way of taking care and showing care for people. And so to be able to open that up to more people would be incredible. And so we're in the process now of figuring out, okay, well, how do we get a little kitchen going? And what would that allow, you know, so we could start doing some like value added products to use even more of the fresh produce and really capture, some of, you know, the vibrancy of the chili peppers and the, you know, the earthiness of the amaranth greens and the, you know, the really unusual kind of sorrel taste that the hibiscus greens have. So how could we, you know, kind of capture those, for year round? And how could that create some kind of part-time supplementary jobs in the neighborhood. So I think ideally the idea is to grow it, but to grow it very slowly and deliberately to make sure that it always does remain more than a business in a way. You know, that those relationships really are central, and that and the kind of neighborhood network is really is really what's primary. But yeah, so we're trying to figure out how we support that work, how we grow it, and how do we have a little space that's not just, you know, I mean, I love that Minara opens her home to people, but, you know, how do we open that up even more? So we're looking for a spot in the neighborhood and to build out a little kitchen to be able to do that.
How does Minara feel about having people into her home? That's a very, it's so generous, and it's not something that would come naturally to most people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best kind of analogy to it is kind of the idea of Southern hospitality. You know, there's this idea of, like, you know, if you go and you knock on someone's door in, you know, the, you know, in kind of like genteel Southern hospitality, you'd get invited in and a glass of sweet tea. And so there's this sense of care that I think is very similar. And Minara has told me stories about, you know, that in Bangladesh, her family would host a lot of parties, and it was, you know, it was not uncommon to, you know, host a wedding for somebody, and there'd be 400 people, you know, and that they would have these pans that were big enough that you could cook a whole cow in one pan to feed 400 people. And so when the first time that Lucy and Molly and some of the other ladies from Roses came by, Minara was so happy, and, you know, and then she said to me, you know, oh, this is what it sounds like to have a house full of sisters. Oh. And, you know, she's one of four sisters. And so I think, for her, she's most comfortable surrounded by a lot of people. And that's been a really wonderful thing to be folded into, and to, you know, that radical hospitality of just like someone deeply caring for you. And wanting to share that and spread that and kind of create more opportunities for that kind of warmth and generosity.
So for people who want to help share that radical hospitality, how can they either get in touch with you or make a donation to the cause or follow you on social? What is the best way?
Yeah, so we're kind of most up to date on Instagram, just because it is such a visual platform, and you know, you don't need a lot of words for it, and just the vegetables kind of speak for themselves. But then we do have a website, so it's our name, Bandhu Gardens, Bandhu Gardens.com, and there's a little button there if anybody feels like supporting the work. And if you're in Detroit or in the kind of Midwest, come eat with us. You know, we post our events there, and we would really, you know, Love to meet more people who are interested in the work.
It is fantastic to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time out to be on Speaking Broadly today. And I look forward to seeing your programs grow and flourish just like those great plants in the gardens. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you so much, Dana. Take care.
Bye. My next guest is Chef Kristen Kish. Kristen has a cookbook called Kristen Kish Cooking coming out this month. You will probably know her as a winner on Top Chef, or if you're lucky, you've had an opportunity to try her food at Montand, the restaurant in Boston, or perhaps even take a cooking class with her at Stir, also in Boston. And if you're really lucky, you might have been to one of her pop-ups around the country at Chef's Club. Kristen popped up, and it was one of my favorite meals of the entire year. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. I am so excited about your cookbook. Of course, because I feel like I've lived through some of it. I've gotten to know Kristen a bit over the years, because when I was at Food & Wine magazine, we had a relationship with Top Chef. So I didn't know what to expect, Kristen, honestly, because, you know, was it going to be the food that you were doing at Montand? Was it going to be food from your childhood? Like, what was it going to be? And in fact, what it turns out to be is really your autobiography, something that touches on things your father loved, something that touches on your travels from the show that you did 36 hours, something from, you know, the time that you spent with Barbara Lynch at Montand. So as your first question, I would love to have you give me what you think your autobiography is through dishes in that incredible cookbook.
You know, when the book was, I guess, the offer to make a book was put in front of me, I took it the second time around. And, you know, even when I took it, I was like, well, what style am I? Like, people will always ask you, well, what do you cook? What kind of food do you cook? And I'm like, I cook a lot of different things. And so I wasn't quite entirely sure of the direction in which to go. But what happened is that we started building my story. My writer and I, Meredith Erickson, who's absolutely stunning and amazing, she started to pull my life story out. And then through that, I realized that my style of food is stories from my life, right? And that's kind of what we all think of when, you know, you're a chef. Like, this is my food. This is what... But what I like to do is tap into... you know, the food that I had as a kid, which is one of my favorite things to do. It's one of the easiest ways to be inspired to create a new dish. And so that's where I started. And then fortunately, in a lot of different ways, because I'm not tied to one restaurant, I could do whatever I wanted. And then we tied it all together with impeccable technique, which is what I strive to do.
So, okay, give me some dishes. So a dish from your childhood that's in the book, a dish from... Stir, a dish from the incredible French chef who was your first mentor. So
I will say, you know, I'll start with Barbara. The one thing that she really, really...
So Barbara Lynch from Montal.
Barbara Lynch, the amazing Barbara Lynch. She really tapped into the passion of pasta making for me. So I have a section of pasta and grains in there, and it's one of my favorite things to do for any dinner for myself, for date night, or for anything. And so I can give her basically all that credit for teaching me the skills of how to make pasta and becoming confident in that.
And which is your favorite dish in the book? Which is your favorite pasta in the book?
Wow. That's going to be hard. Okay, and I'll tie it into a childhood dish, which is... a corn tortellini with radishes and tons of black pepper and like this really beautiful butter sauce. And that comes from, I mean, literally getting out of the car, going down the highway in Michigan, stopping at all these farm stores in a little can, you jump, you know, dump 50 cents in, go grab your corn, and it was complete honor system. And that brings me immediately back to my childhood. And then we bring it back to our home where I grew up. I sit out on the back deck. It's hot. I'm shucking. There's like silks kind of itching my arms. But then sitting down to eat the meal that we all kind of prepared as a family, that was my first true memory of helping my mom cook.
I mean, it seems like you were cooking when you were teeny. I mean, the idea of cooking arrived early.
Yeah. I picked up a knife at 5 and then I started just going for it. And then, you know, obviously through the years, I actually learned what cooking was and not just cutting things up. So,
but you had a mentor who seems to have been a pivot point for you. And do you want to talk a little bit about him and how that ties into a recipe in the book?
Yeah, so the one of the first restaurants I worked at that really tapped into opening my eyes to what style of food I wanted to do was Guy Martin, and then his chef de cuisine was Gerard, and it was this level of dining that I had never been exposed to. I'd worked in, you know, a handful of restaurants, but not to that level, and there was this level and strive for excellence that I really could appreciate. And so I took that and was inspired by him to be like, okay, what is my level of, you know, what's my standard of excellence and how do I execute that? And he really kind of, that was life, absolutely life-changing. I was like, this is the road I want to be on. This is the direction I want to go in. Because before that, I was just kind of flailing around trying to find it.
That's so interesting. And did you feel like within yourself, you had that notion that you would achieve excellence?
No, I never believe that I will ever achieve excellence. I can strive for it knowing that perfect doesn't exist. But what it does is it keeps this little carrot hanging and I will keep running after it fully knowing that I'm never going to get there, and that's okay. But it keeps me honest. It keeps me always striving for something and never feeling like I've ever made it to anything.
There are a lot of people who would disagree with the last part of that sentence, but we're just going to go with you on that. So one thing that struck me in the book is that all of the dishes are magnificently plated. First, the plates themselves are beautiful. And I just found out that Kristen made a few of the plates. So when you see this book, just think in the mind of a chef, you want to not only make the food, but create the plate. But was it at Guy Martin's restaurant that you learned about plating, because it's so sophisticated?
Yeah, definitely. That was the first time that I've ever had to buy a pair of tweezers. had like beautiful little quenelle spoons just to get it just perfectly. Yeah, that's where I was like, oh, wow, this is what it means to put food on a plate. And then through the years, you know, I've learned what my style was and how I wanted my food to be perceived by the diner.
So one of my favorite dishes that you've ever served me was it started out, I saw it as just a bunch of tomatoes, beautiful tomatoes, on a counter in a kitchen. But by the time it came to my plate, the way that you had put the tomatoes on the plate, I'd never seen anything like it before. So because the tomatoes were at different angles, some were sitting on their backs, some were sitting on their stomachs, some were propped up at an angle. What was going through your mind to create that, and how does that, like, what can a home cook do to get a little Kristen Kish style?
Well, at the end of the day, you have to look at what your product is and how it's going to soak in whatever flavor that you want it to be, right? And so, you know, as you cut different, you know, the ugly tomatoes and oblong shapes, and some need to be sliced because they have bigger pockets when they're sliced and they sit on, you know, flat on the plate, and some of them need a little bowl, so you kind of prop them up. Because if you take a tomato, a whole tomato, and dump a vinaigrette on it, it's gonna slide right off. The best thing about tomatoes are these pockets and these seeds that just kind of soak up whatever you want to put on there. And so there's a method to the madness, and you know, some people maybe could see it as being slightly micromanaging of the food, but it's also understanding your product and knowing how it's going to kind of take in the flavor.
Okay, that is not what I thought you had in mind, and that makes so much sense to me, because to me it was as if someone had given you like it was me, and I'm not a chef, you know, it was like being in nursery school and someone gives you all these blocks and you're like, what kind of tower can I build? But of course you're a chef and you're building flavor. So
yeah,
that makes a lot because more sense to me.
You know, as diners, and I think we've experienced this many times as we go out to dinner so many different times, your palate can get really bored very quickly. And, you know, every other restaurant in the summertime, or maybe every restaurant, does a tomato salad, but how are you going to make it different? And how are you going to showcase different flavors so you don't get bored of something? And so that's just...
That's how you think. So I love that you said at the beginning of our conversation how so often you go back to childhood. One of the things that astonished me in your book was that when you went back to childhood, the translation was so elegant. So you would create a Parmesan cheese sauce that in your mind connected you to dipping chicken fingers into cheese. I'm like, okay, that is so distant for me. Or you have this incredible sweet bread recipe that also harkens back to, was it chicken nuggets?
I mean, McDonald's chicken nuggets and sweet and sour sauce from the packet.
Okay, so I got to ask you, how does that happen? I mean, is your childhood memory so strong and so vivid that you're taking texture and flavor and then marrying it to things that you've seen out in the world? Or like, how do you put that memory together with this beautiful food that you now produce?
I mean, at the end of the day, like whether you eat a beautiful, you know, the sweetbreads with the sauce, the Riesling and the grapes, or you had the McDonald's chicken nuggets, what sticks with you is the balance of flavor, the texture, and kind of the mouthfeel of what it is. And it doesn't matter high end or low end, we tap into both of those things in both of those dishes. And so that's kind of where it all started. I was like, God, like who, I mean, maybe there are a lot of people out there that don't like the chicken nuggets and sweet and sour sauce, but, you know, highbrow and lowbrow food, there is not a vast difference. Yes, there's a quality difference for sure. But flavor, texture, memory, absolutely not. I think we're all intertwined in that sense.
It was a leap for me. It was a leap for me, but I'm much happier to go with you like along the sweetbread train. So when I think about the food in the book, you're appealing to people on many different levels. Like I was looking for something to cook for my daughter for dinner, and I found these amazing chicken thighs that I was like, I actually have all these ingredients at home and I could make this. And there are things that are extremely elevated. But many of the recipes in this book show your fine dining background, your exquisite technique. And although it could be technique, I loved that you braised potatoes. Mm-hmm. I've never thought of braising potatoes. Like, oh my God, that was such a cool idea. I ramble. In any case, I was wondering if I sent you into a deli or like a gas station, what could you make me?
Okay, I will give you an example. And so it was, I was in Montana cooking with, you know, good friend chefs or whatever. And, you know, they throw us into like this quick fire. You know, meanwhile, we had, you know, you're drinking cocktails in the afternoon. It was just supposed to be this fun, light thing. And so in the box was canned smoked oysters, barbecue potato chips, and I can't remember, some produce. And I was like, okay, the first thing, and maybe it's because I eat so many potato chips, is I was like, okay, well, this is potato chips, but if you grind it, it turns into flour, and flour you can make pasta or dumplings and all this stuff, and then the smoky barbecue and the smoky smoked oysters, like, this all makes sense to me. Like, in a split second, I was like, yes, I know what I'm going to do. So I ground up the potato chips, mixed in a little bit of rice flour, all-purpose flour, milk, egg, and made a pasta dough, and I basically made dumplings. Okay. And then I made a smoked oyster sauce.
Wow.
So barbecue potato chip stuff. So it's and that's what, and this is what I kind of want the book to be, and why it's so technique driven is once you know the techniques, right, you can apply them and understand what it does to the food. And so whether it's a bag of potato chips or the most beautiful potatoes that were just dug out of the ground at some fabulous farm, you'll know what to do with both of them.
Right. So you're educating as you along the way, because
I hope so. Yeah.
You know, I had never thought of braising potatoes, but now I might think of braising something else,
right,
in that salty, dense liquid, yeah, that you were talking about, yeah, and think about all of the flavor being absorbed through the skin of something.
Right. And I don't necessarily, yes, you can cook them exactly like they are in the book or whatever else, but also, you know, through telling a personal story in a head note, giving you and pointing out the techniques that were brought into this recipe, use whatever you can, you know, like, again, my goal is not for everyone to cook like me. Well, and then I'd be out of my job. So, but I also want to inspire and empower, because that's going back to Barbara Lynch, as a mentor. She gave me the tools, but then she stepped back and let me figure out my own style, which I think is really important. So whether you're a home cook or extern or Comey or whatever, or professional chef, hopefully there's something in the book that you can take away.
I know I have already. So we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Kristen Kish's background. We're going to hear some top chef stories and more. So stick around. We'll be back after a short break.
I'm Michael Harlan Turkell, host of The Food Scene and Modernist Breadcrumbs on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Bob's Red Mill to find out from Bob himself why his products taste so good. So what's the secret, Bob?
To make the best whole grain flour, we look back in time. No modern technology can match the old world engineering of a stone mill.
Wow. Bob's Red Mill is using stone mills? How old are we talking here?
Well, the stone mills are practically as old as mankind, and no matter what civilization they uncover, they find two stones that people were rubbing together to make something they could eat, whole wheat flour. But the stones that we use are quarried near Paris, France, in La Ferté, and it's the same stone material from the same quarry that the Romans used to make stone mills all over the Roman Empire, of which you can testify by looking at Pompeii. It's a quartz material. It has a uniqueness about it. It's very hard. It has a certain porosity, and they put the stones together in a unit of 20 pieces and band it so that they use only the best and sharpest parts. It's an ingenious thing, but very old. I mean, thousands of years old. So it's pretty cool.
Those sound like some really special stones. How do they work?
Stones turn either the top or the bottom stone, turning at 100 to 125 revolutions per minute, produce a lovely 3-4 up to 500 pounds, depends on how soft the grain is. The bottom stone is the bedstone, and it's also called the nether stone in the Bible, but it also now turns for some configurations.
Would you say that using stone mills lead to healthier grains?
I know they do. I can watch it. I showed you. You know it as well as I do. The grain goes in the top, goes through the stones, and it comes out. We don't lose anything, and we don't add anything.
Thanks for sharing the story of how Bob's Red Mill is using ancient technology to keep their products on the cutting edge.
Michael, we think that we can make a difference by sticking by the traditional way of stone milling whole grain, and that's what we're doing.
You can learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Welcome back to Speaking Broadly. This is your host, Dana Cowan, and I am ecstatic today to have Kristen Kish with me as my guest. Kristen, welcome post-break.
Thank you.
I've loved talking about your brand new cookbook that I hope everybody goes out to buy. It's called Kristen Kish Cooking, which, aside from the alliteration, I just think it's very direct. This is what you're doing. We see you cooking in all of the pages, which is great. The book opens with a beautiful autobiographical essay that takes us from your childhood all the way to the present. And you talk about things that are joyful, and you talk about things that are painful, and you talk about a lot of things that you've dealt with along the way. And so I just want to bring the listeners into your world a little bit. You were born in Korea, in Seoul, mm-hmm. and you were adopted by American parents when you were 4 months old, and you were brought to Michigan to meet them, which I think isn't exactly how it would happen today.
Yeah, I think a lot of parents go over and do start visiting.
But in any case, so you were adopted. I made a connection. I wonder if you make the same connection. Your book has a foundation in technique, and one of the reasons it has a foundation in technique is that the book isn't from a place, it's from a person.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's a connection to that in feeling like, you know, your place could be anywhere, and so you're really quite grounded in technique.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I could stem a lot of my personality quirks back to being adopted, and I will happily do that because I don't know how else to relate it to anything. So everything from the slightly, actually overly noncommittal, can't decide on what city I want to live in, I kind of want to travel and do all these different things. Maybe it's because I lived in so many orphanages when I was a little baby, or the fact of how I eat. When I'm hungry and I want a buffet, I want it all at once because maybe back then I didn't really understand where I was going to get my next meal from. So and quirks like that. And I think also there's a sense of control. So a slight control freak. And I think it's because I was so out of control. I didn't have any control over my life or as a baby, as my first 4 months. And so I've learned how to take that control aspect and push it into a really healthy direction, which definitely took many, many, many years. But I think that's where a lot of the technique thing comes from. It's like this idea of control and excellence and perfect. Also relating that to feeling very judged when I was a kid and judging myself, if I can do it the best as I can or try to get it near perfect, then maybe you can't judge me, kind of thing.
So why did you feel judged as a child? Just because you were a non-white child in a very white place? Or
you know, I think it was judging myself. I don't think it was necessarily the people around me. I was surrounded with the most beautiful childhood, the most beautiful friends and family. I think it was me and myself. I think there was a lot of different things. As I got older, I realized it was my sexuality and I didn't know how to deal with that. I was always very insecure and socially awkward. I would get really nervous even up until moving to Boston. I would get on the subway and I'm like, oh my God, not saying people are staring at me, but I'm like, oh my God, what are they thinking about me? And I didn't have any self-confidence and an idea of self-worth yet.
And how did you grow that? Because it's a journey. So like, what are the first steps on that journey to self-confidence?
I played therapist to myself a lot when I was a kid. And I also went to therapy, but I also lied in therapy the entire time. I really honestly believe so much stemmed from this idea of my sexuality and not understanding it and then becoming aware of it and then not feeling like I could actually live it. And so I asked myself why all the time. And, you know, obviously getting older and maturing, you understand how to process that and actually put the wheels into motion to better yourself. And then honestly, Top Chef was a huge, huge player and being comfortable with me. Because I was like, I went on the show, I did exactly who I was. And oh my gosh, it worked. And so it was like,
they liked you.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, I think we all have this thing of like, you know, I don't need everyone to love everything I do, but, you know, you lead your life and, you know, as a kind, caring human being, because one, that feeds your soul, and two, you want to pass it forward, and you don't want to basically be an asshole and then have people think you're an asshole. So, you know, it's been an interesting journey. I still play therapist to myself all the time. But I'm settled in all the imperfections, and I'm okay with that, which actually makes me just chill out.
But of course your food is quite perfect, I have to say. You know, it's beautiful, it's controlled, it's balanced. I mean, your food reflects the person you want to be. I mean,
yeah.
It has an absolute, you know, it has an astonishing quality. So when you talk about coming to terms with your sexuality, like how did you, you know, so you recognized it, and then at some moment you were able to tell the world, call your mom and say, I'm bringing a girlfriend home.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as long as I've known, I can't even remember. Like, I always remembered being like, oh my gosh, I wish I could date this person, meaning a woman, right? All the crushes growing up were all like the female actresses and like some of the teachers and like all that kind of thing. And I think I know what happened. As soon as Top Chef happened, and I was like, okay, I feel confident in some form of my professional relationship. And at the end of the day, I ended up meeting someone that I fell deeply in love with. And I mean, you know, love doesn't solve everything, but it sure as hell solves a lot of different things. And so in that sense, love won for sure. And I was like, it's time. So I told my mom. And once I told my mom, I told my best friends. And then it was like, oh yeah, well, we already knew. And I was like, great. Okay. Now I'm going to start living my life.
And you really felt until then you just were not living your life.
No, I was like, I was muted by so many different things, and I was disservicing myself because of my own insecurities.
So what has changed the most? You know, when you took the mute, but I love the idea of like, you know, taking off the mute button, like when you lived loud, like what changed? What was the...
I didn't have to try as hard anymore. I could just be me. Because when you're trying to control every little thing and you're trying so hard and like this pressure, this legitimately physical weight of something holding you down, you're not performing to the best of your abilities. You're not loving freely. You're not sharing your life with your family and your closest friends even. And so as soon as you take that off, you almost stop, you stop trying, and you don't have to try as hard to be in somebody's face or to be this thing that you think you're supposed to be.
I guess, as you describe it, it saps a lot of energy to be, you know, untrue to yourself and then potentially perpetuating a lie. I love the idea that the idea that you lied to the therapist, you know, but I think you said like, I gave them just enough information to think like, okay, it's not perfect.
Yeah.
You know, like you're just so smart. You know, outthinking the therapist. But of course, it's not a great benefit to you to outthink
the
therapist.
Well, in a lot of ways, I realized, and it's the way my mom mothered me, and it's the way Barbara mentored me. It was this kind of keeping you at a distance, but watching really closely to make sure you don't completely fall, but I'm going to let you fall.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I learn. That's if you tell me exactly what I have to do and like start hammering things at me, I shut down and I will run away from you. So the whole lying to the therapist, like I had to get there myself. Like she wasn't going to be able to get me there. And I know that. Granted, it was a lovely time talking to a human for an hour. But I had to find it on my own time.
And that worked well.
Yeah.
There's another part in the autobiography where you talk about a struggle with depression, but it sounds like it was really related to this feeling of not being able to be, you know, who you are.
Yeah. I mean, even when I was younger, before I realized what sexuality meant, I was controlling everything. I was like, okay, what's going to give me this salary, this car, this house, this job, this life, these kids? I was supposed to do all these different things. And it was just such a burden on me. It started real young. And then obviously becoming more aware of who I am and what depression means, what anxiety means, what social anxiety means, all these different things. I was like, okay, this I have all these things, and yes, and then I started stemming them back and started working backwards and tapped into all my little steps to help heal myself.
That's beautiful. Let's talk about Top Chef, because yeah. I know everywhere I go, people are like, yeah, that Food and Wine thing was fine, but Top Chef, tell me about Top Chef. I'm like, Top Chef was always really, really fun. And I still remember, you know, taking a dish out of your hands. You were at the back room when there were like, you were two people across the back and your dish was delicious. What was that experience like and what's its ongoing role? Like, Top Chef, as I understand it, you have this flash of a moment. And then what you do with that flash of a moment is really up to you. You can ride it out so many different ways. It's almost like you're at a train station. There's a million trains that leave the, you know, the station of Top Chef. So what do you feel like the lasting effect of Top Chef is?
Oh, God. Well, the whole Top Chef thing was I did not want to do it. Barbara made me do it. And I was like, okay. And, you know, it came at the right time where I was looking for this shakeup. You know, I was fresh out of a very long-term relationship. You know, I started a new job. I was ready. I needed something. I was starting to feel bored with life. And so I did it. And I think, I mean, so many different lasting impressions. But for me, the permission to be myself is really the thing that keeps carrying on through and through all the different things that have come after.
So what was your most most favorite moment?
On the show?
I mean, there's so many, right? It's not like you've had a lot of experience on Top Chef by now, so picking one, but...
I will say the most fun for me, because, I mean, it's very difficult to pick a favorite, but I think the most fun for me was there was this quick fire where everything in the pantry was wrapped in aluminum foil. And so you couldn't see anything. And by this time, we had probably shot, I don't know, 10, 12 different quick fires and or challenges. So you know the pantry. And the most fun thing about it was realizing that I kind of had a photographic memory.
Wow.
I went in and like everything was wrapped, but I was like, I've seen this before. I know this. I know where the spices are. Meanwhile, you know, I know where they start and where they end and how they're alphabetically ordered. I know what the oil bottle looks like for the hazelnut oil, but different from the olive oil. And so I made a cake and I figured out where all the baking good stuff was. And in my brain, I was like, finding a carton of eggs is very simple. It's a very simple task. I was like, I'll go that way. But yeah, that was the most fun. I was like, wow. Like,
and who's the chef who you are most impressed with their skill, you know, in the kitchen? Because sometimes you can't really tell, right?
Yeah.
By the time it's edited, people win, people lose, but I'm not sure the best chef always wins.
Yeah.
What was your toughest competitor?
Coincidentally, she is the one who I went up against, but Brooke Williamson, there's something about her. She knew exactly what she was. And, you know, I think when you put chefs on TV or anyone on TV, a couple things can happen. Some people just settle perfectly into themselves and some play to the camera. It's a very awkward experience. And so you get nervous and nerves come out in different ways. And so with Brooke, she was always just so... you didn't even have to see her think. She was like, no, this is my food. This is my style. This is what I'm going to do. And I admired that because I didn't quite have it yet, I don't think. And I probably still don't. But I do have to think a little bit more about it. It seemed effortless for her.
Right. I'm sure if she was sitting in your place, she would say, and it was really hard in there. Kish girl. When you think about the things you want to do more of going forward, so this cookbook is an incredible project. Do you have a sense of, do you want a 40-seat restaurant? Do you want to be a nomad? Do you want, what do you want?
You know, it certainly changed. And what, after I left Barbara, I quit my amazing job that looked so perfect and shiny and lovely from the outside, but I wasn't quite happy. And I think, what do I want to do? Like you said before, it's like all these different opportunities happen. Which direction do you want them to go? And there have been different trial and errors. But at the end of the day, I go back to, okay, why am I, if a project is presented, why are you going to do that? Okay, well, why? And then where does that why lead me for the next three steps? And then I'm like, I'll figure it out afterwards. I do know that being in one spot for the next 20 years in a 20-year lease is not for me right now. And right after Top Chef ended, you know, restaurant offers came in like floods. I was like, okay. And my reason for not doing a restaurant then was, well, okay, if I open up a restaurant now, it's going to get this boom in 15 minutes. And then what happens after that? Like, you know, the next Top Chef is going to come along and where's my restaurant going to be? And I wasn't confident or ready to say, here's my food and I know it's great and it will sustain time.
Do you think that the book helped you define your food in a way that is almost surprising, right? Because you'd think you would get a book deal because you knew your food, mm-hmm. but in fact, through this process, maybe you've arrived at your food?
Yes. I think it certainly changes all the time, given so many different experiences that I have. But the main question I always get is, well, what's your food? And I'm like, I don't know. Hopefully this book is like, I don't have to answer that anymore. I'll just be like, here, and I'll just
take a look.
Buy my book or let me give you a copy. I think it helps myself, but even more so outsiders that have never had my food understand who I am as a chef.
Right, because what one sees on TV, it's you can really see your technique at play, mm-hmm. your determination and skill, but it doesn't have to be your food.
Right, exactly. You know, and that's the best thing is because I worked at Stir and the menu changed every day, and now I'm in doing different events or, you know, 10-person dinner or 100 people or, you know, whatever, my menu and my food has to shift. So my style of food is finding someone else's style that fits the event and fits the occasion. Because I think I've mentioned this to you before, for me, it's about the experience. It's not about the food becomes second to a lot of different things. It's about the experience as a whole and how you feel afterwards, feeling full emotionally and satisfied, you know, through your stomach. So they all work together.
So you've had great mentors along the way. We always close Speaking Broadly with nominating someone into the... you're like, what?
How do no, this is good. This is good.
to the Hall of Dames. So is there a woman that you'd like to nominate for the Hall of Dames? Someone in the food and beverage industry you admire, and then why you admire them.
Okay, so can I give you two answers?
You may.
All right. Barbara Lynch, again, she helped me find my voice and gave me permission to just do whatever the hell I wanted to do and what was me. And secondly, and I don't know if I've ever told you this, but you have played... you have played an incredible role in my career and just, you know, the coming out of sorts, both personally and professionally. We won't go there, but you know, and this ongoing idea of having a friend, a therapist, a mentor, and an inspiring human in one body sitting across from me.
Oh, that's so sweet. Okay, well, guys, that's a really, as far as I'm concerned, a great way to end the show. Thank you, Kristen, for joining me. Thank you, all you listeners, for joining us today. Come back again next week or listen to the next pod. I want to thank my amazing engineer, David Tatasciore, for heroic duty. And see you soon.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
everybody. I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.